Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Reflecting on the nature of the Buddha's teaching and say just as let's say the lay people is taking the eight precepts and the word for precept is sikkhāpadaṃ. I'd say literally means the basis for training, foundation for training. And this is a, it's really sort of like the linchpin or the heart of what the Buddha's teaching is about training. Similarly, it came up in my mind, I'm starting to review the chanting for the ordinations that are coming up, and part of the, of course, there's the precepts for the novices as well, which is also sikkhāpadaṃ, the basis of training. And then in the bhikkhu ordination ceremony, the kind of the wrapping up the last kind of advice, admonition, recollection is that, say, the purpose, foundation, basis of the or the intention of the going forth is to be established in the training, in higher virtue training, in higher mind or higher consciousness training, in higher wisdom. And similar, same word, sikkhā or sikkhittabhanti, just different tense is all. So that that emphasis of training being an integral part of what the Buddha's path is all about. It's not something that is conferred on one through some special relationship with deity or some higher being. It's something that you train to realize, to enter into and abide in. It's not something that is a, say, is a birthright in the sense of, you know, that say some, you know, for some religious teachings, it's sort of, say, just by being born in a certain condition, then you're going to inherit all the benefits of that religion or that teaching or that kind of dispensation. But you know, we have the opportunity to enter into, reap the benefits of that, of the Buddha's teaching, because we have the human birth, but we need to do something more than just be born. Because the natural result of being born is dying. So it isn't the natural result to become enlightened or become awakened. And the tendency for people when they are born is to usually create more problems and difficulties for themselves. That was one of the reasons why the Buddha was reticent, reluctant to teach. You see, you're sort of seeing the nature of the human condition, and the idiom that he uses, you know, obstructed by ignorance and bound by craving. And it's the tendency, being within the human condition, is the being entangled and obstructed by ignorance, not understanding, not knowing the true nature of things, bound and caught up with craving, attachment. But, I mean, he also recognized that there were those beings with little dust in their eyes who would be willing to practice, to train. There were beings with little dust in their eyes who would be really, would be lost without that opportunity to train, to practice, to take the teachings and realize them, make them manifest within their life. So that, we need to be attentive to, what category we want ourselves to fall into. It's not anybody else's we're not relegated to being ordinary unenlightened beings just because of some certain circumstance. We can put forth effort, we can train, we can take the teachings and cultivate sila, samadhi, panya, and penetrate, understand, relinquish those things which create suffering. We can cultivate those things which lead to freedom. We can do that. We can also neglect to do it and muddle along, entangled and bound. But we're the ones who are making that choice. We're the ones who are either putting forth effort or not putting forth effort. It's up to us. It's like Ajahn Chah talking about and saying the that the teachings are like a pasture, and you've got this pasture of sort of nice green grass, and so you let a cow loose in a pasture, and then they'll just eat the grass, and it's sort of quite normal, it's quite ordinary. And you know, if you let an animal loose into this pasture and they don't eat the grass, then they probably aren't cows, and they're probably pigs or dogs or something. So he said, in the same way that the Buddha's teachings are like a pasture, and if somebody is a practitioner, somebody who is intent on freeing themselves from suffering and realizing liberation, then they'll eat the grass. That is, they'll practice. They'll train. That's just natural. And if they don't train, then they're not practitioners. So it's up to us. It's up to us to train. It's up to us to put forth effort. It's up to us to make some effort. Make it clear in our own minds what we want to be doing. Because there's a tendency to either not pay attention to the training, or feeling like somehow it has to be done because the Ajahn says, or the tradition says, or whatever. But no, that's missing the point. We have the opportunity to follow the teachings that have been passed down by the tradition and by the lineage of teachers. But that's our opportunity to make good use of it. It's not because the tradition is forcing one, or the teachers are there to sort of keep pestering and keeping everybody in line. It's not the point of it. The opportunity is ours, and to be able to really recollect and reflect on one's own good fortune, and be willing and empower oneself, enable oneself to train, to practice. Because that's what the opportunity is for. So that that opportunity to train. And that's something reflecting on the examples of others, just in our own lineage of teachers, say Ajahn Sumedho is a senior Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, and reflecting on his example. And that's somebody who put forth tremendous effort and had a willingness to train, going to live in Thailand, live in the northeast of Thailand under Ajahn Chah, in the days when there really wasn't even all that many Thai monks living there. Uh, conditions were quite difficult. Things were very simple. We didn't know the language. But was committed to training. And you know, we derived the benefits of that. Say, without Ajahn Sumedho being willing to really make a commitment to training, then we'd never have had that opportunity to come into contact so closely with this lineage, the teachings of Ajahn Chah, say, particularly through the whole winter retreat. That was the readings that were done here were of Ajahn Chah's, and to recollect that, you know, that, you know, there's a whole slew of really good teachers in the northeast of Thailand or throughout Thailand, but there's not the, say, the access to those teachings because people weren't willing to train under that teacher, that particular teacher, and didn't, for some reason it didn't gel. And say a direct cause for us to be able to access those teachings was, you know, certainly Ajahn Sumedho and then others that trained under him, but particularly Ajahn Sumedho. And then even as a, you know, this as a example of training, I mean, he's continues to, and he's always reflecting, investigating, training himself. I remember one time can't remember how many years it was now, be over 10 years ago, is when I was still in Thailand. He was having heart problems, and so they had this monitor, strapped him up with a monitor, and monitor his heartbeat and rhythm throughout 24-hour periods, so that would only be, I mean, just over 10 years ago. So he'd been, you know, close to 60, been a monk for 30 years or something. And the doctor, when he got the, say, the, I think they did it for a week or something, I can't remember how long. And then the doctors are sort of taking the record and going over it, and they're very confused, because there's this very strange period of time during the night time, their night time, that his heart's going beating really fast, because it starts at, you know, shortly after two, then his heart starts going really fast, and what's going on here? And seems to be consistent every day. So, then he asks for explanation. Well, because he gets up at two and he goes and gets on his rowing machine and does an hour's, I guess, has a shower gets on his rowing machine at 2 a.m. to start exercising, and then he can do that for an hour, have a shower, and then sits meditation. And there's this fluctuation. This is training. He's training himself. He's been training like for years. That willingness to train. Ajahn Chah, and sort of the person we probably most look to as a patriarch in our lineage tradition, willing to, always willing to train. always willing to look at a new circumstance. How can I use it for training? It's like when he was having his, how old was he? He was 63 or so, 62, 63, you know, considered one of the great monks of the time, and has to have a brain operation. You know, they put a hole in his skull and put in a pump, after the operation, then he wakes up. They come to give him sort of painkillers and whatnot. And no, I just want to see what it's like. How much pain is there? How much pain is there from having this? Just to work with it. Train with it, look at it, investigate it, see it, and try to understand it more clearly. There's a constant interest and willingness to take situations to train, you know, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, whether they're sort of wanted or not wanted, and just being willing to train, you know, how to live in a way that, you know, virtue, clarity of mind, and discernment, how can these be fostered? How can they be supported? How can they be developed? How can they be refined? How can they be really laid down with extraordinarily strong and firm foundations? I mean, it's training. It's not about just trying to perfunctorily fulfill some duty, obligation to, you know, some sort of precept or some training rule or some standard within a monastery, within a particular place. And see how much one can sort of coast along with. Because that doesn't get one anywhere. And it's really paying attention to how can I take whatever situation there is and use the precepts, use the situation, use the actual the reactions that are coming up within the mind and train, investigate, work with, so that there's an inclination for freedom, inclination for real relinquishment. The mind inclines more and more to letting go. And it isn't that sort of letting go and relinquishment and freedom come because we wish it were there, or that somehow it'll all happen on its own, without any kind of fostering and nurturing and encouragement on our part. We have to be willing to train. We have to put our effort and attention on training. And there's, you know, there's a, you know, as we gain confidence and gain skill in particular areas of our training, then start paying attention to where those other areas where we're still weak, it's still difficult, it's still you know, there's still obstacles there. And it's not as if suddenly, you know, we're going to wave a magic wand and then, you know, all the difficulties are going to go away and then we're just going to coast along into Nibbana. I mean, it's, you know, whether we, you know, somebody is liberated or not liberated, you know, the world is still the world. You know, we've got bodies that are subject to pain, discomfort, illness. We've got minds that moods, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, continually changing. Just the nature of the world, the nature of samsara. But are we going to be willing to train with it? Or are we going to either, you know, grumble and complain that it is that way, or get fascinated and infatuated with what is pleasant and try to absorb into it and prop it up as long as we can, resent when it does change? It's hopeless that way. And the opportunity for freedom is not trying to gain some particular state of mind that one is going to call awakened or liberated. It's in the understanding, clarity and readiness to relinquish, to let go, to be disenchanted, dispassionate towards, you know, both the pleasant, the unpleasant. And that doesn't mean that one is shutting anything out or that there's any kind of constriction or inability to respond skillfully. We can only be really present when we're willing to let go, when we're really willing to allow the mind to be cool with that quality of disenchantment, dispassion. Not kind of negative and averse to anything. It's just like really allowing the mind to become spacious. Allowing things to fall away. Allow things to drop away. You know, that's possible. But it does take training. You know, one of the teachings that the Buddha gave, which is very easy to overlook, is the teaching to Rahula. And when Rahula was still very young, and the Buddha gives these very beautiful similes at the beginning of his teaching about he goes to visit Rahula. Rahula pays respects and then there's the water for washing his feet, and he takes the dipper and gives various different images for specifically talking about speaking falsely. But after those series of images, and he talks about about training and the willingness to look at something that one is going to do by say, actions of body or speech or mind. One is sort of planning, going to do. And to reflect whether or not it is wholesome or unwholesome, beneficial or not beneficial. And having reflected on something that one is sort of planning to do, is going to do, and then recognizing that it's unskillful or unbeneficial, then to relinquish it, to let it go. To be able to sort of apply the brakes on something that one recognizes is inappropriate. Or when there is actions of body, speech or mind that one is presently engaged in, and one recognizes, or say in the first case, that seeing the unwholesome and being able to relinquish, seeing that it's, if it is wholesome, then to feel encouraged to go ahead with that, have the confidence to go ahead with it. And in something that one is presently engaged in, to be reflecting, investigating, attending to whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, beneficial, not beneficial. And if it is unskillful, unbeneficial, then to be able to stop. To be able to drop that unskillfulness. Or if it is wholesome, then to be able to continue it. You be able to continue what is wholesome. And having completed an action of body, speech and mind, reflecting back on something, recognizing that it was unskillful, was unwholesome, then to be making a firm determination not to repeat that, not to do that. And also to having done something that was inappropriate, unskillful, then to let it be known to some, a Kalyanamitta, a good friend in Dhamma, somebody who is a peer, and recognizing that say something was skillful, was wholesome, then to be able to delight in it, to rejoice in the good that has been done. Because that, that nurtures, encourages. So this, on a certain level, it seems very simplistic and very, very basic. But the reality is that that's not how people live their lives. Whether it's lay people or monastics, we tend to just sort of stumble along and keep repeating the same mistakes over and over again, or come up with some new ones. Both in terms of the clarity around the unwholesome, and that's something that we tend to pick up. Oh yeah, it's like having that kind of clarity around the unwholesome. Really to have restraint and really to try to make that determination not to be. But around the wholesome, we tend not to even be that clear at all, in the sense of we tend, especially I think in Western conditioning, there's a sense of not really, like as if you paid attention to your, the things you've done right, you might get proud. So you shouldn't really think about it very much. But the reality is, in order to have the encouragement, have the kind of positive reinforcement, we have to recognize, oh, that was really skillful, that was really beneficial, that really brought well-being and happiness. And to delight in that, to be able to rejoice in what has been good, good, well done. Because that's also what those qualities of well-being are, all things that lead to one, a sense of encouragement, but the kind of the consistency of states of well-being are also what lead us into calmness, clarity. Because that's intrinsic in wholesome mental states, in the kusala jitta, are also the steadiness, peacefulness, and intrinsic in akusala jittas, whether it's kind of blatant desire, greed, aversion, anger. But even in like restlessness, doubt, dullness, there's a quality of lack of tranquility, lack of clarity. It's intrinsic in it. There's a movement, and wavering inherent in the akusala jitta, in the unwholesome, unskillful mental state. So that it's so important to train and learn how to put one's attention into ways that minimize our hanging out with the unwholesome and unskillful, and support and encourage a dwelling place within the heart that is skillful, is wholesome, is beneficial, leading to happiness and well-being, leading to peace and clarity. And without that foundation, those kind of insight, liberation, awakening, those are all just pipe dreams, just kind of fantasies. Nice fantasies, kind of noble pipe dreams, but without a commitment to training, a willingness to train, then it remains in the distance. So that it's our training that brings it, our willingness to train, our willingness to practice, that's what makes the goal imminent. That's what makes the Dhamma manifest. So to pay attention to training. I mean, it's something that it's, as I said, began the talk. It's a characteristic of the Buddha's teaching. And sort of that is a distinguishing kind of mark. And this is what typifies, or what is the taste, the flavor of the Buddha's teaching, is that we have this opportunity to train. We have the tools to train. We have the framework and the structure to train. And when we put our attention and our effort onto training, the results will come. So I'll offer that for reflection, see.
Sarva karana namase sarva